MenaWatch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank.
Herzlich willkommen, liebe Damen und Herren, bei dieser Ausgabe des MenaWatch Talks. Es ist mir wieder eine große Freude, dieses Mal erneut Rabbi Abraham Cooper begrüßen zu dürfen vom Simon Wiesenthal Center. Wir hatten schon mehrfach die Gelegenheit, mit ihm zu sprechen. Das letzte Mal ist jetzt ein Jahr her. Einiges hat sich getan seitdem. Ich bin sehr gespannt auf unser Gespräch. So, Rabbi Cooper, welcome you back here in Vienna. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us once again. It's been almost exactly a year that we had our last conversation in Vienna, and obviously a lot had happened since then. So I want to address some of the topics that are important, that were important during the last year. Let's start in the United States. Last year we talked about the anti-Israel rallies at the universities and this rather hostile sentiment at universities and university campuses across the United States when it comes to Israel. Now Donald Trump is president again, obviously, and he has, well, one could say, declared kind of war on some of the universities, at least. It was Columbia and Harvard where he announced that he would cut major federal funds for these universities because of the anti-Semitism that was apparent there. What do you make of that? I mean, there are lots of people who think that this is, well, just a pretext and that he cares really not about so much about the anti-Semitism, but rather about other things in connection with universities. But are these the right steps to take?
So it's a fair question. When I think about this issue, I think of a young man named Shabbos Kestenbaum, who's a Harvard graduate and now a graduate student. He went to his university while going through school, asking for protection, asking for intervention, asking for help, and it never came. So Shabbos Kestenbaum, I believe the New York Times is just in a pretty large article on it. He's 25. He had to sue Harvard. Somebody had to pay his tuition. That's a contract. The basic legal, social, and pedagogical contract when it came to the Jews at these elite universities was shattered. There was a president before the current president, said all the right things, but when it came to empower the education ministry, they didn't do their job, not properly. And the signal really was that no one would be held accountable for what they did. So we had at University of Southern California, already going back a few years, two Jewish students were elected to be president and have a senior position. They were hounded off the campus with threats. And there are many examples at MIT. These are their signature schools. Security personnel telling the Jews, well, you know, go up, go back, go up to your class, use the back staircase. There was a fundamental breakdown. And of course, we now know that Qatar invested a minimum of $7 billion over a 20-year period, and others kicked in. And then we also have confirmed that the Iranians were involved in helping to sustain the Columbia University attacks. These were not so much spontaneous, they may have been. And then there's one other comment in the preamble to come to Trump. Dr. Judea Pearl, one of the most brilliant minds in America. I can't even understand the title of his scientific works. I think he invented AI before there was AI. Mm. His son was Danny Pearl, the Wall Street Journal person who was beheaded in Pakistan. And he has devoted much of his life. He and his late wife actually paid for Muslim and Arab journalists to come for 6 months on scholarship to work in secular and Jewish papers. So this is no, you know, anti-Muslim or anti-Arab radical. He's quite really one of the greatest heroes of someone who really has a balance. He said when at a program at our museum, don't fool yourself. There are academics at our universities that have been building underground tunnels for 20 years. So the issues here run deep. And of course, there could be political reasons. Trump had many issues that he put out there. This was one of them, saying, if I'm president, the status quo is going to be over. I'm going to stand up. And by and large, you have to say that, at least so far, that he did. Is it messy? Do you take every single grant away if you have things that are related to cancer research, medical? I think the answer to that is some of those steps have to be corrected. But on the other hand, when you talk about the academic institutions and the arrogance that comes with multi-billion dollars in the bank, you know, Harvard in the 1930s was much more welcoming to open Nazi officials from Germany than Jewish students whose numbers were carefully calibrated. So they have an institutional history when it comes to Jews. It's pretty ugly. And yes, there were Jewish presidents and all the rest, but fundamentally, the social contract, and also not so long ago, starting before COVID, I don't know about the universities here in Austria, but the idea of creating safe spaces and microaggression concerns, and all of that went out the window. And I think one other point that when we look at the universities is that what happened on October 7th and what happened on October 8th. October 7th, we know, was the single worst murderous day for the Jewish people since the end of Nazi Germany. And there was obvious empathy from all over the world again, because the perpetrators were broadcasting their murders and how they were celebrating what they did. Until this day, there's over 350 bags of remains that haven't been identified from that day. So the brutalities are, unfathomable in a sense. But from October 8th on, and it wasn't the first time, but the first time that it was successful, suddenly the narrative changed from the narrative of being pro-Palestinian, changed from two-state solution, changed from debates, where will East Jerusalem be the capital of the Arab state? Where will the final borders be? A whole slew of things that people have been debating for now decades. Out the window. You don't hear, even today, one word. What happened? What happened was, I would say, a sleight of hand. We went from pro-Palestinian to Israel debates to pro-Hamas talking points. The Hamas narrative suddenly became, de facto, the narrative of the Palestinians and all those who backed the Palestinians. There's a lot of blame to go around. I would just recall my first interview on the 9th was from Paris, from the bureau chief of the main wire service from Spain. And she said to me, Rabbi, I just have to tell you from the beginning, my sympathies are with the Palestinians. But, quote, I didn't sign up for this. I thought that would be pretty much what people would say all over the world, but it hasn't been. And I think when you have that kind of embrace and legitimization of a terrorist organization that's not in theory seeking to do stuff, that actually has mass murdered people, and then you see, you experience the silence of the International Red Cross, the corruption and malfeasance of UNRWA, and on and on and on. That is the package that American Jews, most of whom had always voted Democrat, and many of whom suffered from as much as the derangement syndrome as any other American. But for the first time in their lives, their kids or grandkids or nieces and nephews are coming back from school and experiencing a pure form of Jew hatred that we thought had long ago passed into oblivion. Well, it hasn't. So when someone like Donald Trump comes along and says, when I come in, things are going to be different. They picked Leo Terrell, who's an African-American, a black lawyer, civil rights lawyer from Los Angeles. I actually know him from 40 years ago. He's in charge of the counterattack at the Department of Justice against all of this. I think a lot of people are shocked, and there are some Jews, especially progressives, who seem to be inching or have already said, no, we have to fight anti-Semitism a certain way, but if you do this, we're worried that A, B, C, D, and F might happen. The issues raised are legitimate, but the fundamental question is, our kids are in danger. Our place in American society is also under attack, where there are very powerful forces that want to push our community into a corner when we've been a proud part of the mainstream of America now for generations. So I would just say to those people in the Jewish community who've expressed a deep concern that maybe it's too expensive a bill to pay, if you will, to defeat those forces. A, do you have a better idea? And B, where have you been for the last 5 years? Because this goes back even before October 7th. But what happened on October 7th, I think, also awakened an anger, a fear, and an identity among highly assimilated and acculturated Jews, including kids at Harvard and Columbia, at UCLA, University of Chicago. We can go on and on and on. And they have basically, I think, come to the conclusion that they're mad as hell, we're not going to take it anymore. One other point, just to have also a better insight to emphasize, is that in places like Columbia and UCLA, when it came time for those confrontations outside, whether they were going to, some of the instructors, some of the professors, they came out to be on the other side. So there's a lot, there are many different issues that are roiling there. I don't know how much of it spills over here in Austria, which is generally compared to what's going on in the rest of Europe. And I might say in the United States, been relatively quiet. In the United States, we have a broken political culture. People don't talk to each other, and there's a lot to discuss and debate on social issues about the future of our country, and political issues that need to be aired. The media is the legacy media is sort of chosen up sides. They're not doing their homework. They've just more or less serve as a sounding board for a particular point of view or ideology. And on top of it now, of course, we have social media where there's talk about legal action against Wikipedia because they're rewriting history. Though we were talking before about the video that either does or doesn't show three European heads of state with cocaine. Could be AI, could be other manipulation. We live in a time where young people don't really have the facts. Debate over what the facts are itself is extremely corrosive for our society, for academics, for scientific research, for the truth. We're in pretty bad shape at this point. And by the way, there is plenty of blame to go around, left, right, and center. And it's going to take some real leadership on these key issues to emerge from both Democrats and Republicans. But so far, we don't see a lot of that being manifest.
Let's stay with the Republicans for a second, because they're the ones in power at the moment. And I would like to connect this with the situation in the Middle East. When Donald Trump was elected for the second time, there were a lot of people in Israel, but also friends of Israel all over the world who were, well, not necessarily happy, but okay with this choice, saying that Trump was favorable for Israel in his first term, did a lot of good things, the Abraham Accords,
yes,
and others. So they were quite optimistic about what he was going to do in his second term. Now it seems that this optimism has faded somewhat. There were a couple of developments, especially in the last days and weeks, that were rather, troubling for Israel and for friends of Israel. There was this deal or whatever it was between America and the Houthis in Yemen that effectively sidelined Israel or just ignored attacks against Israel by the Houthis, just in order to, make some kind of truce between the Houthis and America. There is this negotiations going on with Iran, obviously, about the nuclear weapons program. It doesn't seem as if Israel was any really involved in this debate or kept. It seems as if it's kept in the dark, more or less, about what is really on the table at these debates. And there is also this upcoming trip from Trump to the Middle East, where he will go to Saudi Arabia and other places, but not to Israel. What do you expect from this trip? And is it true? I read today in the Jerusalem Post that someone said Trump effectively has sidelined Israel, and Israel has lost its influence or its standing in Trump's eyes, and the relationship has soared over the last days and weeks. What do you expect of the trip to Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, in terms of trying to anticipate what President Trump does on any issue, you can start with tariffs, as an example. It's like riding a bronco at a rodeo. If anyone can figure out exactly, where things start, for a couple of days, the stock market almost crashed. Now it's sort of back where it was, maybe a couple of points above. It's very disconcerting for the quote-unquote experts, and also for the consumers, those of us who are, investing. A lot of fundamentals across the board are under the microscope, and some of them are under attack. I am, of course, concerned about Iran, but I also know that there have been significant discussions that I have not been privy to. There's been movement of B-52s and other armaments, etc., including the delivery of armaments that the previous president withheld from Israel during its fight with Hamas. So there are a lot of mixed signals, for sure. And that might be part of his game plan. Where exactly it all lands up, I just think that we have to wait. In terms of Saudi Arabia, a place I did visit when I was the chair of the United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, and a place where I was asked to remove my kippah, and I politely said no and said I'm leaving, and I left. Which led also to an unusual apology by Saudi Arabia. There's no question that they are the number one power in a lot of ways in the region. I would say, and I go to the Gulf fairly often. Maybe people don't exactly say, well, what does MBS say? They are saying, first and foremost, about anything, what does Trump say? In the Middle East, beyond the headlines, everybody wants to know before they make any sort of move, what does President Trump say about X, Y, or Z? And at this point, we don't yet have a lot of clear answers. That's part of it. Secondly, with respect to the media, it's interesting, it's a parallel. Bibi Netanyahu is not a beloved figure in his own country, to put it mildly. The wife and the issues and staying on too long and whatever. So I don't have answers to the questions that you raised, but I take most stories that emanate from about Bibi Netanyahu with a pound of salt. The other thing also about Netanyahu, and I haven't spoken to the prime minister in a couple of years, so not a close confidant, but I can tell you that when I meet with leaders in the Gulf before there's an election, including the last one, they don't even want to hear. They say, no, Netanyahu's going to win again. We need, what are you talking about? He's the prime minister. This whole thing about elections in general, he doesn't always compute. Why? Because they see him as a strong leader. And from their point of view, for their neighborhood, if you will, politics aside, they want a strong Israel for their own reasons. You will not yet see it reflected in votes at the UN. You won't see any major changes in the rhetoric. Sometimes in places perhaps like Bahrain and UAE, somewhat quieted. But you have to be careful when you look at the Middle East to, and I think now that I've traveled a bit, I've been in United Arab Emirates 3 times in the last 4 months, and other countries in the region, including in Africa. There's a big gap between what's reported and what's the reality on the ground. But having said all of that in that region, reality, perception is reality. When Iran saw Israel as weakened internally, they gave the go-ahead for the October 7th attack and everything else that's been unleashed since then. When Israel exudes strength, and I would argue that has to also be moral strength, not just that, that is a precondition to expanding Abrahamic Accords, to making sure that there'll be a day after whatever's going on now and won't be repeated. Israel has to be strong. If it's not, then it's exactly the prescription, I think, for disaster for the whole region, because they often misunderstand what Israel and what Israelis are all about. Probably I would just say this, let's wait a week or two. We'll do another Zoom just on the Middle East and try to figure out, this is what he was going to do in Saudi Arabia, et cetera. And my view about the Saudis and in general about the region is that Israel and friends of Israel need to take a half step back. We're used to, in the Western democracies, there's a debate, there's a decision, there's a commitment, and there's a delivery system. And if you have a ruler, you can draw a straight line. That's not the culture in the region. Culture in the region is much more complex. What you hear is not necessarily what the reality is. Very, very tough to follow. But right now, the complication of trying to analyze people like us, like what actually is going to happen, what's going on, is that two leaders, for different reasons, are despised by a lot of people. And that colors the way in which their actions in foreign policy, in terms of Netanyahu, in terms of how he's adjudicated this war, it colors and impacts the coverage. And I'm talking about stuff within Israel. It's not about anti-Semitism. It is sort of, it makes it extremely difficult to figure out what exactly is going to happen next. I will say, from my point of view, is that we have to figure out for the day after, there are 2 million Palestinians. They're not going to have their future in Gaza. I don't care what anyone says. It's just not going to happen. But that doesn't mean so you walk away. No, if there are 2 million people there, they have to make sure their needs are taken care of while you figure this out. There are countries that will accept Palestinians to leave Gaza, and Gaza has been a hellhole for the people living there. Never mind that they voted in Hamas, but the bottom line is, for a lot of the people who are not connected to the elite, life's been miserable. So there needs to be a change. I believe there will be a change. And the person who instigated the whole thought process and the discussion about it was President Trump, talking about, we'll get rid of them, we're going to put up stuff and rebuild. And maybe the details are all wrong and won't be used, but nonetheless, I think it opened up the floodgates also for Palestinians living in Gaza to talk openly, saying, yeah, if I had the chance to leave for my family, a place to go where I can have a future, a lot of people are prepared to go. So for those kinds of things to happen, you can't just walk away from the humanitarian concerns, no matter how we got there. So you can't disengage from the reality. And to reach the day after where we can talk more broadly about expanding the Abraham Accords, having peace, having, with the exception, I guess, of the Iranian regime until it's replaced, and with the exception of Qatar, which still has the deep pockets and the hatred of the ruling family for whatever reason, they hate us, and they've invested and will continue to invest, unfortunately, targeting Israel. And then you've got Erdogan in the region, who so many different moving pieces. So, it would be very positive development when Saudi Arabia and Israel reach an understanding and have embassies. And allow the business folks who are already finding one way or the other to do it, just to make it sort of like the UAE. Right now, it's normal. I was in the United Arab Emirates before Passover. I had to get back to Israel 2 nights before Passover. I hopped on Fly Dubai, and 3 hours later, I'm in Ben Gurion Airport. And that's the way, not only Jews, but especially us. Like, what have you done for me lately? Not so long ago, the idea that you could go to an Arab capital, get on a plane, or go and have your meetings, and then come home in a matter of hours, I'd say you're smoking the wrong stuff. So there have been a lot of positive changes. When those changes multiply, in my opinion, it will also create an environment for more peaceful reality for the Palestinians. You know, we were all weaned on the following idea. There will be no peace, progress for the rest of the Middle East until the Palestinian issue is resolved. It turns out that one-liner is simply not true, because for Arab countries, and I believe also Muslim countries, that never declared war on the Jewish state. They're not immediate neighbors. They love the idea of the can-do and on technology and biotech and all the rest. And like everyone else in the world, they love making money and they have some money to invest. So all of that, which is the next level, is extremely important. Where individuals and groups like myself, I'm not a diplomat, I don't represent any country, but I think where faith leaders still have what to contribute, I hope to be able to work with people who will put together faith leaders, business people, together, because I'm too old for the talking heads and the photo. Oh, great, you know, you have 18 different groups. What we really need to do, as we call in Yiddish, tachlis, come up with projects, humanitarian, sustainable projects, in which Arabs and Jews work together, Muslims and Jews work together for the benefit of the population. That's, an important way to break the stereotypes. But to bury the stereotypes, we need two things. Political decisions, like those that were made in the UAE and Bahrain, and Morocco long ago. And we need to make available the education materials in many different languages to start from scratch about explaining, well, who are we? Who are the Jews? You know, the Quran talks a lot about Moses is Musa, you have Abraham, you have Joseph the prophet, you have Jesus. So I think a lot of Muslims think, hey, you know, I know everything about these people already. So much so that I remember when I was being interviewed in Jakarta, live, in an hour program on it, of various faiths, the host very politely said, so please, Rabbi Cooper, tell the audience, what does the Torah say about the Quran? Now, that's the largest Muslim country in the world. And so my answer was, well, luckily everyone around this table believes that God gave the Ten Commandments in history. And then as quietly as I could say it, I said, so you see the Torah preceded the Quran. So deathly silence. It was just too much for anyone to really. So we owe it to ourselves to get into a process where we can educate Muslims and who have an interest to know, like, what really makes you people tick. Here's something I learned about second meetings with Muslims. And very educated people, Pakistanis, people in Bahrain, Moroccans, Sudanese. So, and this, I heard this a few times. Rabbi Cooper, you believe that in the Torah? Yes. You believe that God gave the Torah? Yes. So you believe that the Torah is true? Yes. So why haven't you tried to convert me? If you're holding the truth and you're not trying to convert me, you're a racist. You don't respect me as a Muslim if you're the person holding the truth. So I finally asked the third person who told me this, who told you this? It's taught in school. I learned this in school, that one of the things about the Jews is that they don't seek converts. Never, of course, we do accept converts, and we don't seek them for many different reasons. But the idea then is to give it another spin as to why the Jew can't be trusted, why, you know, it's really despicable, you're holding the truth. And so what I usually share with people is the following. Maimonides wrote, a great medieval Jewish scholar, who lived among us, and many of his writings were in Arabic. He said that, he asked the question, who is worthy of going to heaven? And to put it in the vernacular, he basically said, if you're 51% positive in your deeds, you're going to heaven. And if you're 51% the other way, you're not. And then, of course, he added, say, do not try to calculate the value of any particular deed, because that's only God. You might think it's a small or big thing, so just live your life that it's 50-50, and your next action will make a difference, not just for you, but for your family, and et cetera, you know, for the whole world, actually. So I try to explain that we don't believe that heaven is an exclusive club. People may have different paths to God. Some have no path. They choose no path. So when you say, how come you didn't try to convert you? Why would I try to convert you? I'm not holding a key back, holding you back from spiritual fulfillment. And, you know, I don't believe in their description of the hereafter, some of the folks, but nonetheless, the fundamental point about Judaism is personal responsibility, freedom of choice, accountability, and belief in God. Anyone who has those, built in to their world, their lifestyle, their commitment to the society that they live in, to their neighbors, they're going to go to a good place when they pass. And anyone who uses religion as an excuse, say, what do you mean? I followed the letter of the law and everything. Yeah, but you never gave any charity. There was maybe an earthquake. You didn't help. So Judaism is pretty clear, but we're a long way from being in a world where we can share those ideas with each other without worrying about blowback or, you know, insults or all the rest of it. That's where I believe that faith leaders have a huge role to play. I think also, I'm looking as just recently had a surprise meeting with the Syrian foreign minister,
current. That's what I wanted to mention next.
Yeah, so, and he's invited my close friend, Pastor Johnny Moore, and myself to come to Damascus, and tentatively we're hoping to go by the middle of June and not later. It's a very tough decision because the current people running the show, the terrorists, they were terrorists. They're saying they're no longer terrorists. And deep concern because we know what happened with Assad and how he played off minorities against each other and butchered untold numbers. And this is a country now that needs to redo its entire infrastructure and then build. So a quick analysis of, like, why would these people who took over, came in and took over Syria, most of Syria, why would they approach two faith leaders, including like a Zionist rabbi and a pro-Israel evangelical Christian leader? I think the answer to that question actually is quite clear. Whoever is going to be running Syria, these guys or someone else, they can't do it so long as the United States has its sanctions in place. They can't get the investments, the banks won't do anything. And so here they are. They're running the show more or less. And what we found in that meeting, because we came with about 10 questions, tough questions, about the Kurds and other issues. And what we found is very interesting. Unlike perhaps early on, I think they've done some homework. Maybe they've got some training. So what we heard from their perspective, not necessarily mine, were answers and a narrative that in their minds are plausible and promises that they say they can keep. So, you know, Jewish people, in Judaism, we obviously believe in miracles, but we're also taught not to rely on them. So what we're hoping to put into place are some one or two suggestions for humanitarian projects that we would be involved with. We've started an NGO called Our Brother's Keeper, and we would try to put the pieces together. But we told them already, we're not interested in secret moves. Yeah, we'll take help from Israeli doctors, but we can't tell anyone. Or the Jordanian. We think that there are projects that can be undertaken that will signal their own minorities, will signal their neighbors. I'm not talking now politically, because that's up a different league, not my job. But if they actually embrace some of these projects, those are building blocks in one direction. If they say, no, you know, we just can't do that because we're not ready, then they're not ready to lead. And I think the main reason we'll consider going it will be we can test the waters. And if it turns out people can say, well, I told you so, then we can deal with it. But if we have the opportunity in the meantime to see whether or not things can be done differently, it's worth a shot. Just eyes wide open, feet on the ground, GPS well-placed, and also to keep all of the players updated of what's going on. It's interesting, I did, because we met across the street from the UN, and I had a previously set meeting with the U.S. mission to the United Nations. So I debriefed some of their senior diplomats. I was quite surprised because the seasoned diplomats have been around a long time. When they heard about this, they said, not a chance. Are you kidding? Look what the Taliban did to us. They promised us the girls can continue to go to school, that the women could, you know, be out in public, that there could be even the women's football team. 3 weeks after we gave up the sanctions, it's all gone. So, again, eyes wide open, and also trying to understand the fact that in this neighborhood now, you've got the Iranians, you've got the Turks, you probably have the Qataris with deep pockets doling it out. You have the Druze communities that were separated for decades because of, you know, earlier politics. You have the Druze in Syria are endangered. And certainly I think most Israelis believe that they owe their own Druze citizens, that their families and loved ones should not be victims in a charnel house. So there are a lot of moving parts, but what's interesting is UAE, Saudi Arabia, are now loudly saying, we need stability in Syria. My guess is that one of the topics that will be near the top of discussions with President Trump will be this issue. I have no idea how he'll respond. I would just say that for the people who are the professional, long time, quote unquote, Middle East experts, most of them don't want to touch this with a 10-foot pole. But on the other hand, if you, as you know, in the Middle East especially, but in politics right here, you leave a vacuum, someone's going to fill it. So who would have thought, if someone would have asked me 2 years ago, last year, 6 months ago, I hear you, before the end of the year, you might be in Damascus. What? So, you know, the festival of Purim is when you're supposed to be a little bit out of character so that by the time you finish having maybe a few too many drinks, you can't tell the difference between Mordechai, who's the hero, and Haman, who's the henchman. I feel that for many of us in the human rights field, every day is Purim. It's not just Trump. And it's not just the U.S. There's a surfeit in many countries in real leadership, and a lot of confusion, and almost all of our assumptions about economy, about social cohesion within a democracy, about how great it is to get into an Ivy League school because it guarantees you a certain life's path. Take all of those assumptions, sprinkle liberally with the leadership that's in place in the U.S., in Canada, U.K., France, Germany, Argentina, where I've recently met with the president. It is very confusing out there. And the best we can try to do is to live up to our values and also begin to show some more concern for our neighbors, the ones next to us, and the ones far away, because in the social media world, everything global is local. and everything local is global. So if somebody here in Vienna has an idea about how to make sure our kids are properly educated to handle what's coming at them on social media, if it works here, the whole world's waiting to hear. So as I mentioned in some of my meetings here in the last few days, Austria can end up doing everything right. They fight against anti-Semitism and racism and bigotry. They have a coherent, independent policy in addition to the EU. They do everything right. And at the end, it may not be enough because of social media and the 24/7 promotion of all sorts of evil ideas and trying to get the young people, especially who may be searching for something and they want to make a name for themselves. They can land up doing things to any community. And when you look back and say, what could we have done differently? Short of having totalitarian control over communication, it's not clear. There are many, many questions and not yet clear answers, other than we need CEOs who are also concerned about not just the physical environment, but again, the moral pollution of platforms that they're making money off of. Many of them are also parents. We need people to be engaged and also not to rely on governments to have solutions for these problems. That's the biggest escape mechanism there is. And maybe in America, because of the broken political conversation, more and more people are realizing that if you're going to bring change in your community, don't look to Washington. They're the last place you have to look. You have to look locally and work with people there.
I'm afraid it's not really an optimistic perspective if you've got a person like Elon Musk at the head of Twitter to ask for more moral responsibility and stuff like that. But just as a side.
No, I think your point, I've raised this with Musk, and I've said to him, the only thing I'd like to do is, I have a few experts for decades. I want to send them to sit with your experts. Let them look together at the algorithms and do some tweaking. But I think in general, not just him, let's be honest, Zuckerberg, all of them, we would dealt for nearly three decades now with the companies, with middle and upper level management. They got it. They got the message. They wrote the memos to their bosses. And in the end, by and large, the companies decided we need the clicks, we want the money, and they bake it into their business model. That is, unfortunately, the truth. Can it change? Yes, it can still change. But until then, the people who are most targeted in the first and last line of defense are 10, 11, and 12-year-olds who don't know anything about anything. So it also means that for those kids who are lucky enough to have a family, we need the adults in the room to get involved and actually trust your children to tell you what it is they're seeing and explain to them the difference between an idea you may not like and something that's downright dangerous. Don't leave it for the classroom. Don't leave it for the clergy. That means that we need parents to be more, not less, involved with their kids. I'm lucky because I'm a Sabbath observer, so I can't use the computer 25 hours a week. Without it, I'd be on it 8 days a week, like everyone else, and the kids, etc. So we need to try to help our children find a way to identify with values. A society that has no values is doomed, no matter what the birth rate is. A society that has values and teaches children that values are important, that's the good basis for discussion, for debate, which part I'm going to absorb, which I'm not. I want to look elsewhere at different worldviews. I want to travel to understand. Those are all healthy reactions. But in order to get to that point, you really can't blame governments. We probably could have had a lot more help from the school systems and maybe even some clergy. But I think it really does start with the parents, and that's not a message any of our overworked women and men want to hear, but I don't see any other way out of this.
I'd like to finish our conversation with something that's specifically related to Austria. We had, you've been here a week ago, you told me before, so maybe you already have taken notice of that debate. There is a former ex-president, or an ex-president, an Austrian ex-president, who felt he had to say something about Israel and the Gaza war these days. He spoke of, I quote, "the outrage at the way Prime Minister Netanyahu and his so-called war cabinet, as it calls itself, made up of right-wing extremist government members who flaunt their Zionism, is waging war against the population of the Gaza Strip." And he kept on saying it was appalling, and it's all the worse because we are very positive about the fight against anti-Semitism. But none of this, and we acknowledge the suffering of the Jewish people in the 20th century, but none of that justifies treating people, women and children, the way they are treated here, meaning the Gaza Strip. And he also said, he compared Israel's war against Hamas to the Russian attack on Ukraine. And then he finished by saying Netanyahu is not reducing anti-Semitism, but increasing it, and this must be stopped. What do you think when you hear something like that from someone who was supposed to be a respectable politician?
He's dead wrong. And I think he forgot one small factoid, unless it's part of another part of his statement. What did he say about the hostages? And does he have a response to the fact that Hamas, any time that wants this war to be over, simply needs to lay down its arms? They'll be well taken care of by the Qataris, don't worry. The leadership, they're not going to suffer. They'll be out somewhere in some Riviera. Lay down your arms, and the suffering is over. I remember, I think it was the first month, I was invited to CNN in studio, which was unusual. The segment before me, which I wouldn't have seen if I was on Zoom, was somebody in Gaza who said that multiple members of his family had been killed by an Israeli bomb the day before. And when the host for CNN was about to start asking me my questions, I said, look, before I say anything else, I want to express my condolences to the gentleman who was just on in the previous segment. I also want him to know that the blood of those innocents are on Hamas's hands, not the Israelis. I was in Israel for Passover. On the first day of Passover, I was in the synagogue in a Talmud class. And the siren goes off because of narcotic-chewing Houthis who probably don't even know where Israel is, for whom this is a good business with the Iranians and maybe others. Is there any other country on the planet that would tell its citizens, okay, when it goes off, you got to go into the bomb shelter? This is a group of terrorists. They're not even close to Israel. They're 1,500 miles away. No other country would have shown the kind of restraint that Israel has. Yes, I say restraint, even though right now the vast majority of above ground Gaza has now been reduced to rubble. So it's a very unfortunate, tragic thing. It's Israeli, men, young men who've lost their limbs. It's the wives who lost their husbands. And I would say that with all due respect to people who are sitting in their ivory towers in another location, as you know, it's a Jewish trait, but it's true in Israel too. You have two Jews and three opinions. The IDF is a citizen army. And what was being asked in an emergency situation because they weren't ready for war. And it continues now. If the average Israeli citizen, many of whom have already spent months and months in the military, thought that this was about a monster called Netanyahu and lunatics, extremists on his right. By the way, he has extremists on his right. But that is a grotesque mischaracterization of the reality in Israel. Because for this particular battle, after what Hamas did to their children and their sisters and their mothers, they don't need a pep talk from Bibi Netanyahu. There's so many horrible aspects to this, but it turns out that many of the people who were tortured to death, were burned to death, were raped. They were the leaders of the peace movement of Israel. They were the neighbors of Gaza. You had some of the women who would drive kids up to an Israeli hospital who were getting cancer treatment. They knew where each of these people lived. Hamas knew, probably told by some of the people who were helped, and they were butchered. So how convenient it is for someone who wants to see all of this end, hates Bibi Netanyahu, makes a caricature out of him. And again, when I go to Israel, every weekday night, you hear the drums banging, you have the protests. I happen to have, my family has an apartment nearby. It's not pleasant, but that's what a messy democracy is all about. There are plenty of Israelis who think he didn't do it right. He did it too fast, not fast enough. He cared too much about the hostages or hasn't agreed to do, you know, enough for them. That's the reality. It is a damn chutzpah of quote-unquote statements from here, from someone who should know better, because who will be energized by his statement, his gross mischaracterizations? Hamas and their Hamas's supporters. It's a bonus for them. When you talk about what goes on campuses, what we really need, and people ask, what about, do you believe in a two-state solution? My answer is right now, there can't be a two-state solution because there's no negotiating partner. The minute a new Palestinian leadership comes up, and there are people with other voices, you'll have a deal. If those voices never show up, there will be one state, and they'll figure out something for the Palestinians. But you know, you just have to ask the Israeli Druze and the Israeli Arabs. It's not a perfect country. It's a tough place to live, but it's their home. So it's not an apartheid state. There is no genocide that's going on. And just the fact that you can repeat it and get brownie points from all sorts of enemies of peace, enemies of Israel, shame on you for talking that way. Just an outrage. Maybe someone who's well-educated, has a long history, might be worthwhile looking back in history and looking into the mirror. You're not helping bring the war to an end. You may be satisfying whatever it is or expressing some frustration. That's not leadership. That is beyond unfortunate, because I think Israel and the Israelis and Palestinians are going to need people to stand with them. And yes, there are a lot of people who manage to stand with both people, but only those who are not committed to Israel's destruction. And if you look at the polls that are taken among the Palestinians, the majority still think October 7th was a good thing and that Hamas was right to do it. Would you do a two-state solution if that's what your neighbors believed after everything? So we have to move from the theoretical to the reality. When you stick with your friends, you can have a private conversation, whether it's the president of Israel, who's very involved, or draw a straight line to Netanyahu. So if the person who made the statement can get his get a meeting with him. That's where you express it. Wagging a finger at the people of Israel and the Jewish people doesn't go over very well with us. We don't need Eitzegebers that are making their criticisms based on political considerations and not the truth.
I would say we can wrap up things at this time, at this point in time. Thank you very much once again, Rabbi Cooper, for taking the time to speak with us. As always, very interesting and very insightful. I hope there'll be another time and place where we can do it in the near future.
I look forward to it, and hopefully we can look back in the rearview mirror and talk about the day after, because there's a lot of healing that has to take place for both people. And I think that this country is well positioned to actually help in both of those areas. And that's exactly, I think, where in the 21st century, where Austria should be.
Thank you very much.
MenaWatch, der unabhängige Nahost-Think-Tank. Besuchen Sie auch unsere Website. Dort finden Sie täglich neue aktuelle Berichte und ausführliche wissenschaftlich fundierte Hintergrundanalysen zur Geschichte und Gegenwart der MENA-Region.
Eine Produktion von MENAWATCH, dem unabhängigen Nahost-Think-Tank. Auf unserer Website finden Sie täglich aktuelle Informationen und Analysen. Besuchen Sie uns.